ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Justin Hazelwood grew up in Burnie, on the northwest coast of Tasmania. For years, he imagined Burnie as somewhere he had to leave, especially if he was going to be any kind of artist. And there were other, more personal reasons that made staying in Burnie complicated. Justin's mum has schizophrenia, and growing up, he was her carer, something he did his best to hide from teachers and friends. So after school, Justin headed to the mainland and did the tough work of building a career in comedy and music. But life can take unexpected turns, and Justin's path took him back to Burnie. He now has a new book, Dream Burnie, which celebrates the creative humans like him who are making art far away from the big cities. It's also a book about going back to your hometown and writing an entirely new story there. Hi, Justin.
Oh, hi.
When you were growing up in Burnie, where was the best place to get takeaway?
Takeaway? Gee, you'd have to go to the Chick Inn. I suppose on a Sunday night, it was very common for Mum and I to drive home from Nan and Pop's in Wynyard via Cooey, where the Chick Inn was, and, you know, did the quality barbecue chicken and chips. Mum got the Hawaiian pack. I had these sort of traditions of looking out for the blue cross on the ride in. There was a neon blue Christian cross up a hill, and from a distance you'd just see this blue dot. And I had these sort of childhood rituals driving in at night. I just loved the glow of the neon of the 80s. So even the Kmart sign was sort of exciting somehow.
So this was home for you with all of its special symbols and rituals. How would other Tasmanians have described Burnie back then? What kind of reputation did it have?
I bought a backpacker guide from 1991 and I was looking through it, and the backpacker guide was really struggling to find angles to sell Burnie. It actually said not a whole lot of interest to tourists. And I had to laugh. I was like, this book's entire purpose is to encourage tourists to come to the town. Look, it was an industrial town. It made its choices. The powers that be made their choices. And I feel like they made a choice where we're going to serve the industrial overlords first and we'll serve the citizens of Burnie second. And the payoff will be we'll employ very large volumes of the citizens of Burnie. And so the pulp mill was a huge employer of about 4,000 people. And being a conservative sort of place, a lot of Christianity, a lot of sport, probably a lot of low-level homophobia. It was just the time and the place. It all felt a bit, what are you looking at, mate? I wasn't dead comfortable in that environment. I was a little nerd. I was smart, wisecracking, thoughtful. I had very geeky glasses and a little bowl cut. I was running the school newspaper and things like that. And there were a lot of terrifying older men around in their hotted up Commodores.
Take me inside your house. Who lived at home with you?
I just lived in a red brick government housing unit, really a nice little unit with a nice garden and in a court with some other little old ladies. And it was just me and Mum and the cat.
Was your dad on the scene at all, Justin?
I don't know my dad. I've never met him. So long story short, he abandoned my mum and I when I was a baby and very successfully went on to have his own separate family. And we just had no contact with him whatsoever. And at a very early age, my mum sort of gave me the talk where she showed me a black and white photo from the Advocate newspaper, and she's like, see this man, that's your father, and this is his name, and this is sort of roughly where he is. It's a pretty amazing story in itself. He lived 20 minutes away from me my entire life, and I've never met him. Pretty nuts.
So it was just you and your mum, and as I said, your mum has schizophrenia. How young do you remember your mum not being well? Was that always a part of the story, or is it something that changed as you got older?
Yeah, when I was prepping for this interview, I wasn't thinking of a lot of things, but I was like, make sure you tell everyone what a great mum was and what a great person she is. Because the thing about mum and why I got so sad that her mental illness took her away from me was because that's someone I love. I was just in love with my mum. She was just so sweet and kind and thoughtful and funny. And we just had a real rapport. We had a bond from such a young age. She was a Mothercraft nurse in the late 70s. So I had a mum who actually went to school to learn how to be a mum. I mean, how lucky am I? So I just remember her spoiling me and carrying me to bed or scratching my back or, you know, cooling my toast because I liked it cool. Lots of little favours. I wanted to watch the second instalment of Sesame Street in the afternoon, even though I'd watched it in the morning, and Mum wanted to watch The Sullivans. But I remember putting my little foot down and getting my way. So she's very kind. And then I just got an early memory of, I don't know, her schizophrenia had pretty wild symptoms. She was quite discreet about it. I mean, she wouldn't be doing these things at the dinner table or in the line at the bank or anything, but just in her bedroom, she'd be making some pretty strange sounds. She's sort of talking to her voices. They'd either be in a good mood and she'd be laughing along at something, or things would turn and she could get quite angry and be sort of swearing to herself under her breath, quite violently. And then sometimes the dial turned and she would just be doing this sort of like howling performance, crying. I've got this memory of being in bed. I was in the room next to hers in my little bed. I had this Sesame Street hardcover book and a red texter, and I was like doing these little spirals and I was monitoring the volume of Mum's sounds next door, and I'd like make the spirals bigger when it got louder and smaller when it got quieter. Mm. So that's one of my earliest memories. I was probably about 6 or 7 of really beginning my lifelong relationship with hypervigilance and hyper-awareness of my mum and what my mum was doing at any given time. The slightest change of an eyelash in my mum's eye after a while might be enough for me to go, I reckon mum's getting sick again.
So her symptoms would come and go, Justin. Is that what it was like, that there'd be periods where she was in that good, loving place that she so clearly was and would have wanted to stay in, and then periods where those difficult symptoms of schizophrenia would really come to the fore?
I mean, my mum would be well about 2.5 months of the time and then become sick again and stay unwell for about 2.5 months. And I swear it was just this loop we were on essentially my entire childhood up until age 18. From as young as I can remember, it was just this seesawing, slow-moving, Jaws meets Groundhog Day of this low-lying dread that Mum might be getting sick again, and then this outrageous delight when Mum returned, came out of the fog.
Was she getting any psychiatric help?
Not really, and not enough. She had been hospitalised when I was just a baby. I was a baby in a psychiatric unit. I dug out some old medical records at one point and was trying to get my head around how all that played out. But she was severely unwell, but just well enough to hide it from the public. She had a doctor. They didn't really do much. I don't think she told them the full story. She was just on these Mallorol tablets that made her a bit of a zombie. So Mum and I did an amazing impression of being a normal family, to the point where I'd go to school and be a pretty good student. and Mum was even Mother's help at Montello Primary. And so that's well how high-functioning Mum was. I think that's a testament to her character. I think she worked so incredibly hard to think about how she was going to be a good mum for me the next day, despite what she had going on in her head.
The way you describe it, it sounds really clear that she wasn't getting the support that she needed, but nor were you as her child. Was there anyone that you confided in or could reach out to help?
Look, I had surrogate parents in my Nan and Pop. I'd go over there every weekend, almost without fail, to Wynyard, and it was a real saving grace for me. The thing is, Nan was sort of like my life coach. She's an extremely strong-willed, tough, older lady, very of that generation of the northwest coast of Tasmania. She was sort of the wore the pants in the relationship, and she was just like, what are we going to do about your mum, Justin? Is she taking them tablets? Because she'd been raised on the farm and not really given a childhood and made to look after her siblings from age 9, she was very good at not really giving me a proper childhood. She just passed on this legacy of, you're a man now, Justin. This is at age 11. So Nan and I would have these pep talks on the swing seat while she's drinking her home brew and I've got my glass of Coke, and we'd look out over Nan's sprawling garden that she'd mostly landscaped and built herself. And we just, Nan would be like, what are we going to do about your mum? She's not looking real well, is she? And she'd just be talking at me like I'm another grown-up in the room. And I just sat there and went, well, okay, I better fire up. I got to meet Nan halfway here. So I wasn't like the other kids, you know. I don't know what the hell the other kid's biggest problem was. I can't find my footy sock and I can't get the video going with the new TV. My biggest problem was like my Nan wants me to keep an eye on my mum to make sure she's taking her tablets.
You made a lot of cassette recordings of your family in your childhood. What was that about?
This is pretty cool. I mean, when I was 8, I got this good present buying by Mum, I believe. It was a little red, sharp cassette boombox. And the day before the Caulfield Cup 1988, I decided to put a tape in. And I'd obviously been playing with it and recording myself or taping over other tapes and mucking about. I've got this tape still that has plasticine jammed in the holes so that I could record over it. And I just thought, if I press record and just leave it and it's sitting here on the bench at Nan and Pop's, I'm just recording Nan and Pop and Mum chatting away, and I'm just going to leave that and I'm just going to capture the next half an hour, you know, like a kid collecting butterflies out in the backyard. I developed this, it's a cross between a kind of party trick and a game for myself, and probably a survival mechanism if you want to really read into it. But it began this childhood hobby of recording my family. And after a while, I would sort of be the host of the tapes and be like, hey, dudes, Nan's had a few beers. Let's go see what's happening in the caravan. And I was like a little Daryl Summers sort of addressing this audience.
How was it a survival technique, those cassettes?
Look, I say that because, you know, been doing 10 years of therapy and writing about this stuff and goodness knows what else. And I think I should point out how outrageously isolated I was at home, essentially living in a unit with a parent who was not present and would sort of disappear for long periods of time for all intents and purposes. So I needed to exist. Like, I was at risk of disappearing.
Your Uncle Ken had an influence on you in terms of recording and music. Tell me about him and how he helped kind of awaken your own songwriting.
Yeah, it helped having a musician in the family. Ken was a country music singer, sort of country rock, and he did his own shows in clubs and pubs around the Canberra area or down the south coast of New South Wales. He'd come home and sort of visit for these short periods of time and bring exciting musical gadgets and albums. And there was this record in the Nan and Pop's record cupboard, which was Ken Hazelwood's Old Blue single about his car that he'd recorded. So I was fascinated with that, and we'd put it on, and, you know, he had his own original thing going on and was writing his own songs, which is a great thing to have a role model doing that so close. And he helped pick out my first guitar, a classical nylon, when I was in grade 5. And that began my journey of just learning basic things on the guitar. And then within a few years, I'd actually be writing my own songs.
What were your first songs about?
I entered the Parklands High Talent Contest with this, the Home and Away song. Yeah, it was like turned on a TV screen and there was Irene. I wish I'd never seen her going off at Selena. And there's Flame and Alf with his flame and shop. And here comes Tug to buy a carton of milk. And it was just this little three chord punk song.
It stands up. How did the audience respond at that talent quest?
Kids loved it. Got lots of laughs. And it didn't take long for me to work out the power that a funny song can have live. And I thought they were just such a cool thing to... I love the format, you know, 3 minutes, few chords.
How did a conversation with one of your teachers at high school change your plans for after school?
Oh, well, even in grade 12, creatively I was kind of firing on all cylinders, and I was putting on gigs in the school caff with my original kind of funny songs. But not a single grown-up ever really talked about what I wanted to do with the rest of my life or whether I wanted to go to uni at all. So best I could come up with as a plan was I'll go and become a cadet at the local newspaper, The Advocate. Journalism seemed to be the main path to a career in writing. So that was the whole plan until my favourite theatre teacher, Amanda Mearest, gave me a bit of a pep talk, which she essentially just said, oh, just, that's all well and good, Justin. Just picture waking up at 6 a.m. in the middle of winter in Burnie and going to work at the cadetship in the Advocate. And there was something about that moment. I sort of wandered along to the career advisor's room and picked up a pamphlet for professional writing at University of Canberra, and it had Maurice Gleitzman on the cover. And I went, oh, well, that'll do. I've got an uncle in Canberra. I want to be a writer. So that was my decision-making process to how I went to uni.
Were you keen to leave Burnie by that stage? Like, were you thinking much about what the world outside of your hometown might be like?
I think through my teenage years, I had this really palpable sense of wanting to reach the rest of the world. Like, when you live on an island, you're very isolated in ways you don't even know, and it's just a different mindset. And it was the mid-90s and we didn't have the internet, and I was just glued to Triple J when it came to Burnie, and I was ringing up the request line and I was requesting songs. I was recording my own little home albums, and I'd even sometimes sample the applause from a Nirvana MTV Unplugged tape so that there'd be clapping and cheering at the end of my songs, and I'd be like, yeah, thank you, you know, like a weird American accent. So, like, again, it comes back to a bit like the childhood tapes. I had this sense of, like, this wider audience out there that I was sort of desperate to connect with, even if I didn't quite know how or where they were. And I just think this energy was manifesting itself. But perhaps by the end of year 12, I don't know, my morale had dropped a bit and I'd sort of given up on... I didn't know how to leave, probably. So the fact I chanced upon this pamphlet, honestly, I reflect back on it now and I can't quite work out how I left. I was like, how did my family not pressure me to stay and keep an eye on my mum? That alone is sort of miraculous, really. I think you just got to say, God bless my family for, like, letting me go. And one way of looking at it is they, especially my nan, had really pumped me up my whole life to, like, you've got to have a dream, Justin. You've got to follow it. The strong survive, the weak they fall. And they'd been pumping me up my whole life to be this outstanding leadership material, A-grade student, which I'd essentially met all of those requirements. They couldn't very well turn around and go, hey, you know what, just hang about here for a while, just settle. Because I was just all guns blazing, going, oh, I'm going to be really ambitious and take risks and go over to Canberra and chase my dream to be a writer. So I don't know, they just had to let me go.
You talk about the isolation of Bernie, particularly in that era. You know, isolation has all kinds of consequences for places, and it can create different kinds of humour, I think. What kind of humour flourished in Bernie when you were growing up there? What was unique about the way people made each other laugh in Bernie?
I met up with a friend from primary school, and he reminded me of something I had no memory of, but it was me and Paul and Nick. We got Nick's boombox and we brought it to school. And at Nick's house, I'd recorded a tape of me going, help, let me out, I'm stuck in the cupboard. But what I'd done is built in 30 minutes of silence on the tape, and then the voice started kicking in. And on April Fool's Day, we would have come to class really early, put the boombox in a cupboard in the classroom and pressed play. And then all sat down at our seats and class would have just gone on as per normal. And then, like, imagine being the teacher this day. This voice was like, help, help, I'm stuck in the cupboard. Would have started up out of one of the cupboards half an hour into class. And I was just pissing myself hearing this story again, going, that's just classic us. I think there's probably a great case of having almost nothing to compare yourself to and not really any blueprints for how something should be done. So if you want to put on a gig at school or if you want to make a funny play up in your bedroom and record it on tape and bring it to school, you could just make all that up in a way that suited you at the time. I like to think that there's this sort of theme of the smaller the town the artists grew up in and the more cut off from everything else, just the more interesting stuff they came up with. I've always thought Tasmania has a unique sense of humour. I think the northwest coast of Tasmania, you know, some of the people I was getting around with at school, Josh Earle, who's gone on to lots of big things in comedy. You've got people like Hannah Gadsby coming from Smithton. There's definitely been a vibe of, like, we're just a little bit different to our mainland counterparts, a little bit more of a wacky, inventive edge.
With that edge and the inspiration of your theatre teacher and not being stopped by your family, you headed off to Canberra to university. What were you like as a first-year student?
It's a wild adventure. I'd had this nickname, Fonz, my whole life pretty much. I picked it up in grade 8 and it just never left, and I spelt it P-H-O-N-Z-E just to be different.
Fonz, because you were so cool, or how did you land Fonz?
I think it might have been ironically used, perhaps. I was in grade 8, I was sitting next to a kid called Elvis. I don't know how many kids called Elvis in the world, but Elvis Connolly was like sort of my friend slash rival. We were hanging out in the back of the bus and I had my hair slicked because I started using mousse. And this grade 10 kid turned around and goes, oh, look, it's Elvis and the Fonz. And that, from him saying that once, it just spread like wildfire. And I basically had my name taken away from me and no one called me Justin ever again. And I was just Fonz. And I got to Canberra and I was probably Justin again. And it lasted all of a few weeks. And then I joined a theatre society and wrote this really wacky song called Spanky's Lunch and played it drunkenly at one of their parties. And the president of the theatre society just went, I reckon we're going to call you Spankies. And so I lost this nickname and picked up an even worse one almost immediately, which is very me. I mean, I'm just, I don't know, I walk around with a bit of a target on me. I just wanted to reinvent myself like a little supernova of energy. I wanted to be free of everything that was in Tasmania, just all this baggage. In Canberra, it was just this fresh blank slate of making brand new friends. Some people probably go over halfway around the world and backpack for 6 months to have these sorts of adventures. But when you're from Burnie, Canberra's like New York with roundabouts.
You threw yourself into writing and performing at university in Canberra, and you won the ABC competition Haywire, which led to you having a regular gig as the bedroom philosopher on the Triple J Breakfast Show. How big a deal was that to you?
That was my dream job. I don't think I've surpassed it. Like, I came out, I nailed my dream.
At 21.
I had such a front-loaded career. I basically came out of the gates with the dream opportunity, whereas most people toil away for 10 to 15 years doing a bit of a slow burn. I was just like, hey, kid, have everything. Have the keys to the kingdom. And so I was just thrust into this platform of, you know, forget Lena Dunham. I was the voice of a generation.
It's describing when you were a little kid recording cassettes, you'd imagine this audience, this huge audience that you wanted and wanted to connect with. Did that happen once you had this role with Triple J? Were you able to kind of find your people and then find you?
Well, it's amazing, isn't it? Imagine if it all played out now. I would just turn on my laptop and my audience would be like coming at you through social media. But back in 2002, they were still a bit abstract, this sense of an audience. They weren't really there. So I would listen to my songs on the radio and the hairs would prickle on my arms and I'd be recording them on tape. And it was like electric. It was like taking a little electricity pill of excitement, knowing that I was sort of wired in to the country. I just had this sense of being plugged in and that all of Australia was kind of listening to my 3 minutes of airtime. I don't know. After that, I was sort of done. Like, I didn't need lots of emails or lots of validation. I didn't even really need to know what people thought that much.
What about, you know, you're described as a kid feeling so lonely. Did having an audience change that feeling?
Yeah, I mean, I worked at the Canberra Labor Club and there was the day someone I didn't know said, hey, I heard you on the radio. And that was sort of ground zero for fame, if you like, which was I sort of began apologising almost immediately and was really awkward and sheepish and like, oh, yeah. Because being some sort of self-loathing Tasmanian, I don't know, the fame thing was, it's kind of awkward from the start because people are coming at you to heap praise on you and put you up on a little pedestal and you're almost wary in advance of where all this is going and you're like, oh, yeah, okay, thanks, just did this thing, not a big deal.
Is that because you, like, at home that would be considered big-noting yourself or something? Or what's that voice in your head about?
Well, yeah, it was pretty huge. Pretty strong. My whole life had been designed to put someone else ahead of my own. Like, I sort of think the syndrome of that manifested itself in different ways. I think I had a hard time having things for myself. Everything was sort of about looking after mum, and I would be sort of more worried about what my friends thought than what I thought about things. And it was sort of two forces fighting with each other, because I had a real sense of pressure on myself to perform and be this amazing person everyone wanted me to be. It was a lot going on for a kid who hadn't had a day of therapy in their life and had just come out of this elongated childhood anxiety and trauma episode, and now I was sort of entering into super success, fame land. There was a lot going on.
Meaning you were then performing live shows, started performing at comedy festivals. What would audiences get, Justin, if they came to one of your shows? What would they have experienced?
Just manic energy and madness and a sort of bizarre Jarvis Cocker, sort of off-brand Jarvis Cocker in a ski suit, strumming away madly, squawking these philosophical sort of lyrics about being in love with Kelly the deli girl or buying a golden gay time. And I was sweating away up there. I wasn't sure what my costume was supposed to be, so I grabbed Nan's 1970s ski suit, and I think I needed to feel protected or something from the harsh light of the performance world I was entering into.
You kept a pretty frantic pace over those years of performing and writing, and it seems like you were doing a million projects at once. How did that kind of all fall in a heap?
Yeah, I mean, essentially my whole 20s was just spent working, desperately trying to keep fueling the bedroom philosopher rocket ship to wherever it was going. Yeah, it was pretty wild. I mean, by 2009, I think I was trying to do a weekly sketch comedy radio show on Triple R while recording an album, while filming some stuff for John Safran's Race Relations. And then maybe I'd be doing gigs of a night because I needed the money. I had no concept of taking breaks or self-care. You know, Nan's voice going, "You've got to have a dream." And my teachers going, "Justin has good leadership potential." I was like, I wasn't allowed to stop because I'd been given this amazing opportunity. So I just had to hit some kind of wall. And even if I hit the wall and kept going, like not even a wall could slow me down. I hit a few metaphorical walls. Like that's how fast this machine of me was going. I mean, I got car doored on my bicycle when I was 30, halfway through a Melbourne Comedy Festival, where I could have won the Best Show Award. It was going so well. And it almost accidentally on purpose had this accident on my bike because I didn't really know how to get a break from my life. Like, it's a lot of fun. It's sort of mostly awesome. Like, girls liked me a lot because of it. And in terms of having a kind of lonely childhood or even a lonely high school years, because I was this Coke bottle kid with a bowl cut, and girls didn't really pay any attention to me for 3 years at high school, which really bummed me out because I had a lot to offer. Little wisecracking nerd me. So when I was popular with girls in my 20s, it was amazing. I've just got to point that out because like life, it was brilliant and amazing and behind the scenes sort of terrifying and anxiety-ridden in equal parts. I rode the waves just like a crazy cool ride at the show, which you can do in your 20s, you see. Your 20s are absolutely designed for that. But your 30s are a different picture, and the whole narrative of my life in my 30s changed.
So when you crashed through a wall that you couldn't crash through anymore, what did that look like for you?
Well, the whole thing kind of ground to a halt. And my soul was like going, "Hey, so how are we doing?" The answers weren't great. And you'd wake up at 4 a.m. and stare off into the great void of the universe and be like, "Hey, how are we going, though?" You know, and the answer would be, you know what? I think we're in a little bit of trouble, and I just had a breakdown, and I went to ground in many different ways. And it coincided with the waters breaking on my childhood memoir, which, you know, I'd known my whole life I would eventually write. My shopping list would say milk, eggs, bread, write childhood memoir, drop off laundry, stuff like that. So I guess I began this creative breakdown therapy bomb side of my life where I was just by myself a lot with low energy, light sensitive, noise sensitive, not really able to function in the world other than to start offloading this compounded grief of my childhood, which had just built up like layers of sediment.
Did writing it down, Justin, into your book, into Get Up Mum, did that help shift the weight of it?
It's like 90% therapy, 10% entertainment, 0% income. Like, that's why I do this. Look, I'm trying to make something be awesome, I'm trying to make it fun, and I was trying to do the really hard scenes as well. My entire childhood hinges on me ringing Nan and Pop up midweek and saying, I can't handle Mum's crying, can you please come and get me? Which is what would happen sometimes. I had to pay a lot of attention to what happened in those conversations and what was the voice on the other end of the line saying, and did Nan and Pop come and get me? They didn't. And, yeah, the obvious question is probably why.
What kind of response did you get from readers after you'd published that book?
Yeah, so I like to do a very, I like to do a wacky, ambitious book launch, you know, because everything's so heavy with mental illness, and as soon as you start talking about it, you can feel the weight in the room grow. And I got nice emails, just like when I first got played on Triple J, I got my first email of like, hello, Justine Hazelwood, can I get the lyrics to your Happy Cow song? And so then with this Get Up Mum book, people were like, oh, you know what, I had a mum with schizophrenia as well, and she did these unusual, wild things, and I really appreciated your book. And in terms of whether I feel like a success in my career or as an artist, honestly, getting emails like that is enough for me. I'm kind of done and dusted in a way. If I can, like, give words to a subject that is almost impenetrable in how abstract and confronting it is for people and exhausting, and gives people some kind of access point to reflect on it in their own lives, I just think that's a miracle of time and space. And I feel connected. You know, I'm of use to people. I'm very happy with that because, gee, I got my ass kicked as a kid by this illness.
You know, you spent all this time writing about Bernie, thinking about Bernie, talking about it. Had you spent much time in the place since you'd left all those years ago to go to university?
Bernie, we care. I got obsessed with the tourism slogan from Bernie in the 90s. It just says, Bernie, we care. Now, look, maybe it's saying it in a more friendly tone than that, but you can just look at it and go, Bernie, we care. And I was hanging out at the Bernie Museum, and this lady was like, wait a moment, and she went out the back and she came back and she had all these stickers, like mint, original, silver writing on red. It's like a map of Tassie with a little star coming out of Bernie. She gave me these Bernie We Care stickers, Bernie of the 90s, which is essentially where I either live or I certainly lived for several years in the Bernie of my memories. It's funny. The postscript of all that is going back to Bernie in the real time, which is, you know, it's way more home and away-ified. The sea's blue again. The factories have gone away. There's nice blue poles and canopies down at the beach. It's like Bernie kind of started trying in the 2000s and it was sort of interested in the concept of a tourist wanting to come or find it nice. Yeah, I mean, you've got that and you've also got the world's biggest pile of wood chips, like this bizarre Egyptian pyramids meets wet cheese sort of vibes. So Bernie's still the industrial piece of work it always was.
What led you to move back in 2019, Justin?
Oh, I just really loved the show Rosehaven and I was like, I'd like my life to become a quirky, dark ABC comedy. And I was just really bored and running out of material. So I thought, I'm a big fan of Mother and Son by Jeffrey Atherton as well.
I see. I'm getting all these gag answers, but tell me why you moved back underneath beyond all of that. Dear. This is conversations. I actually want to know.
Now, it's good, isn't it? You just witnessed, like, the Justin Hazelwood comedian defence, like on a...
well-honed Tai Chi move.
It's like on Starship Enterprise, when the ship's in danger, all these automatic defence systems will come into place. Like, you just saw my comedy equivalent of that. I was just like, start doing gags, because it's like, it's so hardwired in me to be funny. I was very exhausted from living in Melbourne. I couldn't really handle the city anymore. Melbourne's not really the same place it was in 2008. It just felt like a hectic, slightly overcrowded city. And so Melbourne is just growing while I, as a person, seem to be becoming more sensitive. I was just like, can't really do this anymore. So I went back to Bernie. Mum seemed to need all this help, you know, to write Get Up Mum. I had to sort of have all this space from my mum and not really go home for 2 years, which was a pretty big deal. And I'd never really done anything like that before. So by the time I went back, Mum had developed rheumatoid arthritis and was sort of looking all crippled and unwell and hobbling about. And honestly, it turned my hair grey, the events of 2019, seeing Mum like that. I was like, holy shit, got to get Mum some medical attention. So go back home to deal with the third act of Mum and I's relationship, which has essentially been a 5-year journey of getting her the NDIS, getting her a lot of medical care and re-establishing networks in a town with a notoriously compromised health system. So I'm my mum's carer, but as I say to her in my lower moments or my more exhausted moments, Mum, you know, I'm not that well myself, but I've got to do this job, like, because it's my mum loved me so much as a kid, as a baby. I had so much love around me that I want to help my mum. It's this, you know, powerful force field that exists.
So it was partly out of this responsibility to your mum and partly out of having had enough of Melbourne that brought you back to this town. You know, I began by asking you how it looked to your eyes as a kid. How do you look at this place now?
Like, I don't do drugs. I don't need to because my life is so wacky. Like, just living it is a trip. Like, being back in Bernie, the last place I thought I'd ever move back to, and walking around going, oh, it's like day 305, like you're still here in Bernie. What are you thinking and feeling? I guess I'm on a mission of, like, connecting with the place as a grown-up, and it does get exhausting walking around being nostalgic all the time. So once I realised they'd taken the neon blue cross down from the house on View Road, I thought I'm going to draw a line there, and there's going to be old Bernie of my childhood and there's new Bernie now. I was quite determined to work out what I thought of the place now. I lean very hard on the nature side of things. It's got some lovely parks and reserves. I really like ducks. I like being around ducks, I realised. I just think ducks are the best. And seeing ducks go about their business. Even picking up rocks off the beach that have cool stripes on them. Bernie beaches have real funky kind of mod rocks. I should tell you the little tale of finding a wedge-tailed eagle feather on a little bushwalk I did by myself in 2019. And that felt so incredibly profound and meaningful. And I know the wedge-tailed eagle is an incredibly important figure in Indigenous Dreamtime stories. And that honestly felt like the universe just communicating with me somehow, saying, take strength, Justin, it's going to be okay, mate. These are the same sorts of conversations I'd have as a kid. I was like, does the universe care what is happening to me? Like, does anyone care? Like, is anyone paying any attention to me and to this? It's got to be some sort of force watching over my life. You know, it just has to be.
The book Dream Bernie that emerged out of your time being back there and connecting with other creative people who call Bernie in the northwest of Tasmania home, who's this book for?
Well, I was hanging out with Lyndall Thorne of the Bernie Arts Council. She was trying to manifest this project, honouring some of the artistic alumni of Bernie, of which they had this long list of 100. And I was just in Bernie trying to work out how the heck to make myself useful as an artist, sort of cooking up this ambitious project of, well, I could interview 20 of the artistic alumni and could really get into what they think of Bernie. And so it sort of grew from there. And I was sort of trying to tap into some of the beautiful bits of Bernie and the nostalgia and the quirky things. And I thought, what if we made this incredibly awesome, colourful book, which is just all about Bernie, not even about the northwest coast or about Tasmania. Just go full Bernie, the most Bernie book of all time. Just double down, triple down on how niche it is and just be unapologetically niche. It occurred to me in that moment that that was absolutely the right direction to go down. Just celebrate your village.
When you say that, it sounds like one big difference between the Justin of Bernie Mark 1 and the Justin of Bernie Mark 2 is you're in the village. You're not trapped in a unit with your mum thinking, how the hell do I get through this? But you're really in that village. You've got a community of people around you.
I'm on some sort of mission to feel, it's like, I need to plant my flag in Bernie. Somehow, mum and I were so invisible in my childhood, but then I announced that through my book, Get Up Mum, and I sort of came out of the closet of being a child carer and lifted the rug of schizophrenia where everything gets swept under. It's like I presented myself and my mum to the town and said, hey, by the way, this is what two people living with the disability of mental illness looks like. In the same way you would do it for MS or for cancer or for any of other life's ailments. Well, schizophrenia is just another medical condition and it's normal for some people, and this is exactly what it looks like. And I want to be able to walk around the streets feeling with my head held high and like I belong there, and that I'm not some weird hipster blow-in from Melbourne who thinks he's good, or whatever baggage I might have going on in my head. I just wanted there to be a positive narrative with my hometown that I could manifest. and create this positive sort of gold card for networking. And I thought, if I do this book, everyone who's remotely awesome or cool or smart or into the arts will gravitate towards me, and I need more people to go out for hot chocolates with. So it's a pretty selfish exercise, and there you have it. I've given you the secrets of showbiz.
I think Bernie is very lucky to have you back.
They'll learn.
They'll realise. And before too Bernie's long, it's like, going to be your face on those tourism stickers. Bernie, Justin Hazelwood's hometown. People will flock there. Thank you, Justin, for sharing your story on Conversations.
Oh, thanks.
Justin Hazelwood's new book is Dream Bernie, and his memoir is Get Up, Mum. This conversation was produced by Nicola Harrison and recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri, Turrbal and Yagara peoples. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.